talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the story of Ireland through its records, the life and legacy of Roger Casement, the role of the RNLI in Britain and Ireland over the past 200 years, and we'll find out about the Anglo-French War of the late 13th century and how it laid the foundations for the bloody 100 Years' War that followed. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we looked at the life and music of Tchaikovsky and discovered that there was more to the composer than the cliché of the tortured artist. And if you want to listen back to that or to any of our older shows, just go to the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud, our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. A new exhibition, Society and State, Ireland Through Its Records, presented by the National Archives, showcases a selection of records which chronicle how the state and Irish society interacted from the 1920s to the end of the 20th century. The exhibition begins in a period of expansion and a newfound freedom after centuries of British rule and ends in the 1990s with the increasing liberalisation of Irish society and the emergence of the so-called Celtic Tiger. And to talk to me about it, I'm delighted to be joined by the Director of the National Archives of Ireland, Orla McBride. Orla, you're very welcome back.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
It's a fascinating exhibition, and I suppose the context is provided by the 1926 census, because that was where the new Irish state was making its plans and trying to work out what it needed to plan for.
Yeah, so following the establishment of the Irish Free State on the 6th of December 1922, the government set about the task of nation building, because the public services, the infrastructure, everything that was in existence when the state came into being were all inherited from the British. And the government set about creating a distinctively Irish state for its citizens. So, as you say, one of the first tasks or one of the first acts of that new government was to undertake the census of 1926. And this was the first census that allowed that government to begin to plan for its citizens. So it looked at everything from, you know, obviously it was establishing a new nation. So it was looking at everything from identity and, you know, symbols and the flag and the harp, etc. But it was also then taking the information that it gathered in the census in terms of the population, how many men, how many women, how many children, where they lived, what their lives looked like right across the country. And then they began to plan. So it was looking at everything from infrastructure, public services such as health, housing, and then beginning to develop policies and initiatives to progress Irish life over the intervening decades, bearing in mind the huge economic challenges that the new government faced. But one of the first things that they did following the establishment of the state was to begin to say, okay, well, what are the symbols of the state? What makes us Irish? What do what are those distinctively Irish elements of look like? So that was the tricolour. Obviously, we know that the tricolour came into being in 1840, but there was much debate, and in the exhibition you can see the agreed colours that they agreed in 1922 in terms of the adoption of the national flag. Then they moved on to the harp. It's the official symbol of Ireland, and that dates back to the 16th century. But the decision was made in 1922 that the harp would become the symbol of Ireland. So those were one of the first things that we did. And in the exhibition, we show, you know, minutes of meetings, we show diagrams, even the coins. So they had a coinage committee. So they were looking at, you know, the different coins for this new state. And interestingly, of the first coins that were minted in gold and in silver, they were sent to the Vatican, and we have a letter from the Vatican thanking the Irish government for the sending of the first coins that were minted belonging to this new state. So straight away you can see how that relationship between the Catholic Church and this new emerging state became cemented quite early on. And then we move on over the decades. And, you know, one of the first then major public moments for the Irish state was the Eucharistic Congress of 1932. And that was huge. 250,000 people came to Ireland for the Eucharistic Congress. I myself have my own story to tell. My grandparents, my grandfather was a national school teacher on Gull Island in Donegal. My grandmother was from Donegal too, but had gone to New York in the 1920s to work, and came home with her aunts for the Eucharistic Congress because it was such a huge moment for Irish people, both home and the diaspora. And they met at the Eucharistic Congress, and who would have thought, where love stories begin. But again, that was so significant that actually, from an infrastructural perspective, the new state invested huge resources. There was a massive, obviously, we had the huge mass up in the Phoenix Park, but there was a PA address from the Pope in Rome to the address in the Phoenix Park. They had this extraordinary altar established on O'Connell Street. Like, it was massive. They had temporary accommodation for all of the people that were coming home. People were coming up to Dublin, etc. We think about the Pope in Phoenix Park in 1979. This was the first Pope come, you know, the Pope didn't physically come to Ireland, but it was one of those major moments. And again, it spoke to the Irish government and the Catholic Church and how intertwined they were from very, very early on.
And other great infrastructure projects you see with Ardna Crusha, rural electrification, that there's a big focus on creating the I suppose, the means by which the state can live.
Yes, exactly. And obviously, Ardna Crusha was an extraordinary infrastructural project, but it was one of the biggest in the world, really, at the time. From our perspective, you know, the construction of the Shannon hydroelectric scheme began in 1925. They brought the German company Siemens Schuckert over, and the ESB then was established in 1927 to establish the scheme. But at the time, it was the largest hydroelectric power station in the world. And it provided the country's sole electricity source up until the 1930s. And then as demand increased, obviously, then we saw other stations on the Liffey and other stations around the country. But even then, in 1946, only two-thirds of all rural homes, that's about 400,000 in the country, didn't have electricity. Albeit that it was very significant in the 1920s, it took right up until the 60s and the 70s before we had full electrification in the country. But yes, that was one of the biggest projects for the new state when it began in the 1920s.
And the exhibition really shows how Ireland was transformed over the different decades. You know, electrification was one of them. Free secondary school education in the 1960s was another.
Yeah, and that was probably, I mean, we would often say, and looking at the records that we hold in the National Archives, that was probably the single biggest transformative moment in Irish life when Donal O'Malley in the 1960s, primary school education up until the age of 14 was mandatory. Up until the 1960s. Secondary education was optional and it remained really out of the reach of most families. But in 1967, free education for all children was introduced by Donal O'Malley. And it was, as I say, probably one of the most important developments in modern Irish education. And there's a letter that we have from Donal O'Malley to Lamass where he's putting him on notice, really, that he's going to be speaking at an event the following evening and he was going to announce it. Lamass, it's very clear from the record that we have that Lamass knew that this was going to happen, but the rest of the cabinet didn't. So it is famous for its reputed spontaneity. The cabinet apparently were completely unaware of it until he announced it at this press conference in 1966. But as we know, Sean Lamass privately was very supportive of the scheme. So yes, and we also then have a focus on, so you can see those kind of public services and how they developed over the decades. So that's education, obviously, in the 1960s. But obviously, we all remember and you know, people and their families or whatever would have their own stories in relation to, you know, the public health challenges of the new state in the first decades. TB, obviously, consumption was one of the leading causes of death death. So there's, we have significant records in the exhibition in relation to the introduction of the TB vaccine by Noel Brown, and he embarked on this very, very ambitious program for the eradication of TB in 1948, and we have records relating to that and St Alton's Hospital, and just, you know, even the little brochures that were obviously sent around to different homes, encourage little photographs of children with a smiling nurse, etc., encouraging families to take up the vaccination program. You know, we lived through it a number of years ago with COVID, but these were the early kind of, you know, big vaccination programs that were very transformative in terms of the eradication of TB in Ireland.
What about 1973 when Ireland joined the what was then the EEC, now the EU? How much did that change our society?
Well, one of the big changes, and you know, we have in the exhibition the application from Ireland to join the EEC. And then we also have the cabinet minutes, where you can see that the cabinet are discussing the fact that the European Economic Community, as it was in those days, said to them, you need to look at several different things within economic development, etc. But you also need to look at equity and equality between men and women in Irish life and Irish society. And as we all know, up until then, the marriage bar was in existence. So one of the first tasks that the government had to set about in response to joining the EU, or the EEC as it was to lift the marriage bar.
And some of our younger listeners may not be aware of just how difficult it was for working women, that in the public service, as soon as you got married, that was it. You had to leave your work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody probably has their own stories in relation to that. My own mother had to give up teaching after she married. So yes, so up until 1973, a woman working in the Irish public sector had to leave her permanent post upon marriage. So the marriage bar was lifted on the 31st of July, 1973. And it was mainly really, as I say, because of the obligation for EEC membership. So the marriage bar, I think, you know, obviously once that happened, you could see then other developments. So we had women's rights, those kind of movements. We remember the contraception train. All of those things really began to take shape following the marriage bar. We had the UN Declaration on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women in 1967. We were behind the curve a bit, but actually that was the moment that you could then begin to see the early signs of liberalisation in Ireland. Had that not happened, we wouldn't have had the election of Mary Robinson as the first female president of Ireland in 1990. And we have records in the exhibition that speak to her election in 1990 and how extraordinary that was as a moment. And then we move on, obviously, again, as part of that journey towards liberalisation. There's obviously a focus on abortion, divorce and sexuality, and we have the case that Senator David Norris took against the Irish state to the European Court of Human Rights in 1988, and his victory, I think, paved the way for the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Ireland in 1993. So we stopped then, because the National Archives only has records up to 1993, but in a way, the lifting of the marriage bar, the election of Mary Robinson, and the decriminalisation of homosexuality, and that extraordinary case that the Senator Norris took, they then speak to what we know happened thereafter, which was marriage equality, repeal the eighth, etc. So the exhibition takes us from those early days of, you know, what coins, what symbols will represent the state, through to the modern Irish state that we all live in now. And that transformation really is reflected in the records that we show and as we look through different lenses of Irish life in those 100 years.
And you can really see how different Ireland was back in the 1920s and the 1930s, even when you look at popular entertainments, when something like the dance halls, and how closely they were monitored and scrutinised, and making sure that nothing immoral was happening in them, and that the youth of Ireland was being corrupted. And, you know, so it's very much a window into a very different world.
Yeah, I mean, who would have thought that we would have had a Public Dance Halls Act in 1935? which obviously that brought in specific regulations in relation to licensing, etc. But it also allowed an interested party, for example, like a parish priest, to object to the issuing of a license. But it also allowed the Gardaí free rein to police the venue. So in the exhibition, we also have reports from Gardaí in relation to dance halls in their local area, and you know, they would actually record if there was any sexual impropriety or any the consumption of alcohol, etc. So even the you know, the popular culture of the day and the dance halls as it was in the 1930s, they were all under the watchful eye of the local priest and the local Gardaí. And that moved on then even to look at other forms of popular culture. So you look at things like, you know, cinema. Irish people loved going to the cinema, but only the cinema that Irish people were allowed to see. So we had the Censorship of Films Act, we had the Censorship of Publications Act. So you can see that, again, from our earlier discussion in relation to the role of the Catholic Church, that public morality was a huge concern for the governments of the day, and they took it very, very seriously. Even in the exhibition we have from the censor's book, we have the report on Breakfast at Tiffany's. Now, I mean, I'm sure many listeners know Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, a very lovely little film with Audrey Hepburn as this kind of ingenue in New York. It was banned. And there was no way it was ever going to be seen in Ireland, because, again, you know, there were, was she a prostitute? Was she not a prostitute? And there was no way that the Irish audiences were going to be exposed to that kind of film. And again, we didn't lift that until, I mean, The Life of Brian was banned in the 1980s. And the same with the Censorship Publications Act. So we know that Edna O'Brien's The Country Girls was banned. We know, you know, so again, you could see the Irish state policing not only dance hall, but policing culture and how people in Ireland consumed culture and what that looked like.
Well, it's a wonderful new exhibition. It's called Society and State, Ireland Through Its Records. It's running in the Dublin Castle Gardens on Dame Street in Dublin in the Coach House Gallery until the 8th of September. And Orla McBride, Director of the National Archives, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. In 1904, Roger Casement became internationally celebrated for unearthing the grotesque violence of the Belgian Congo. Soon after, he won even greater renown and a knighthood for his humanitarian work deep in the Amazon jungle. But his internal fault lines ran deep. He was of the English diplomatic establishment, yet an outsider who fought for Irish nationhood. His final act in wartime Berlin, a doomed scheme to promote an invasion of Ireland, and it overwhelmed him. And it is really only today that we can fully understand how surprisingly modern and deeply relevant is the life and legacy of Roger Casement. And it's all explored in a new book, Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. It's published in hardback and paperback by Bodley Head. The author is Roland Phillips. And Roland, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
Can we begin with a question about just how celebrated Roger Casement was for his humanitarian campaigns, exposing those atrocities in the Congo, exposing what was going on in the Putumayo region in the Amazon? He really was an international celebrity, an international humanitarian.
Absolutely. The whole world over, in the United States, he was a huge name, as was later shown when he needed support in the United States. He was knighted by the British establishment. He went on lecture tours. Arthur Conan Doyle supported him to the end of his life. Many other famous figures backed him because he really did expose for the first. He was the first great humanitarian of the 20th century, without a doubt, decades ahead of his time. And he exposed these appalling atrocities in the Congo and in the Amazon that both changed international law and resulted in King Leopold being forced to sell his colony, in effect.
So how did this Irishman working for for the British Foreign Office, exposing all of these atrocities, knighted for his efforts in 1911. How did this man become then this Irish nationalist?
I think there are two major reasons for that. The first one goes back to his childhood, which was very dysfunctional, disconnected. He was often very young. His parents were alcoholic. And I think he had this enormous emotional hole in him, which he filled with campaigning. So his sympathy for the oppressed people of the world was immense, and he threw everything into it. That's point one. Point two is a more practical one, as it were, that he, through witnessing colonialism in action at its extremes, as in the Congo in particular, he grew to abhor it, and he channeled both that emotional sympathy and the abhorrence of colonialism into the Irish nationalist cause. So close to home, he found a cause that he became passionate about, and that was how he started out down his ultimately tragic path.
And I think another part of the tragedy of Roger Casement is that even though he was this internationally respected humanitarian, this nationalist patriot, in later years, all people seemed to want to focus on was the question of his sexuality, his diaries, and that seemed to overshadow everything else that he did in his life.
It did. And I also think his sexuality was a cause for the tragedy, in that he had to keep, by law, his sexuality so hidden that he could only turn outwards. He only had one significant relationship in his life with a man who betrayed him to the British, a Norwegian sailor who was his lover and companion for 18 months at the end of his life. And this was exposed. No one had any idea in his lifetime that he was homosexual, but when, after his arrest in 1916, the British establishment leaked his diaries from 13 years earlier, 1903, where he detailed, I mean, not in sexual detail, but in financial and practical detail, encounters in London in 1903 with having paid sex. And that brought about, in the end, finalized his execution. He'd been found guilty of treason for his actions in Germany. But there was a huge, because of his international standing, outcry to get him reprieved from the gallows. And the British ambassador in Washington was saying, you cannot hang him or the Americans might not join the war, because the Irish-American lobby was so powerful. And Conan Doyle and all the great liberal intellectuals were presenting petitions, and the Archbishop of Canterbury was petitioning the Prime Minister. But the moment these diaries were publicised around the establishment, all this support fell away, and there was no question of a reprieve after that.
And they were even shown to the American ambassador to Britain, and then he made sure that the message was sent back to President Woodrow Wilson in America. And if the Americans had intervened to try and save the life of this international humanitarian, it could have been very different indeed.
It could indeed. And they'd passed a resolution in the Senate already to reprieve him, in so very, very high level stuff. But you're right, once the ambassador asked, in fact, he asked for the photographs, he got wind of them and showed them round, as you say, Woodrow Wilson and other senior government ministers, and that was it. And it became inevitable that America would join the First World War.
There is a word that you used repeatedly in the book that I think is quite interesting. You use the word lonely, and that definitely comes through in the book, that he does seem isolated, alone. And maybe we should say a little bit more about that relationship with Adler Christensen and the betrayal there, because I think that treachery did have a huge impact on that sense of loneliness and isolation that he did feel.
It absolutely did. I think he was made lonely by his upbringing and critically by his sexuality. So there's such a huge part of himself that he had to keep hidden that he never really made friends until in his 50s he met this Norwegian sailor, 24-year-old Norwegian sailor in New York, and they became lovers. And Christensen went to Europe with him. Casement was going to Germany to raise troops to invade Ireland during the First World War. But Christensen, immediately they landed in Norway, went to the British legation and told them everything, who he was traveling with and so on, because they were under assumed names. Meantime, telling Casement that they'd approached him. So Casement felt betrayed by the British, whereas in fact he was being betrayed by his lover. And this became a sort of terrible web of intrigue, of Casement trying to send false information and Christensen exaggerating it, to the point where it severely affected his mental health. And he spent Christmas 1915 in a sanatorium in Germany, miserable, depressed. His physical health was never good after his time in Africa. But this mental health swell. And by the time he came back to Ireland on a U-boat on Good Friday 1916, he was a very sick man. He was depressed. He was paranoid. He felt that the people he'd worked for, the British Foreign Office, were now betraying him, which in fact they'd been so forced to by Christensen. And it was a terrible web of treachery that I think added greatly to his tragedy.
And I think Casement's whole role in the 1916 Rising isn't really properly understood, even after we've had the centenary of the Rising and so on and all the commemorations, because it's always seen as, it's always remembered as Casement coming to provide aid, but actually Casement was trying to prevent the whole thing.
He knew it would fail because the Germans had basically gone off the idea. They weren't providing sufficient arms to arm the Rising. They provided 20,000 rather rusty old Russian rifles that were intercepted by the Royal Navy, and the ship was scuttled. And Casement's return was, he was determined to prevent the Rising. Of course, it was far too late, because he knew that if the Rising failed, which he was convinced it would, that would set back the cause rather than help it, because there would be a military clampdown and so on. So he's, for the sake of Ireland, he was determined to try and stop the Rising.
And Casement was transported over to England and put on trial for high treason in the summer of 1916. And his trial and his whole defence, it just seems to have been messy and messed up from the very start.
Yes, he was tried for adhering to the King's enemies, as it was called at a time of war, and which was not in dispute. He'd been in Germany trying to raise troops to invade Ireland. And his only defence was really on a point of grammar. He knew that being tried, that the British were determined to have a civil trial because he was a famous man, and they thought if they had a military trial, which would be behind closed doors, that would be a propaganda disaster, whereas to have a public trial, civil trial, was the only answer. Also, a military trial would have to take place in Ireland. So Casement, He made his greatest speech after he'd been condemned to death, where he really discussed the nature of patriotism, said that if he'd had a trial in Ireland and an Irish jury rather than a London jury, the case might have gone very differently, and he was only trying to serve his country and so on. It was a marvellous speech. But it was a shambles. He couldn't find anyone to represent him in the end. He got an Irish counsel who didn't have the privileges of an English counsel in the courtroom. And it was a pitiful affair.
And you mentioned the punctuation there. It was always said afterwards that he was hanged on a comma, whether the statute applied to his treason because it happened outside of the United Kingdom.
That's exactly right. And the legal establishment took that very seriously. They went to look at the original statutes on parchment from 1351, that was the statute he was being tried under, decided there wasn't a comma, it's just a fold in the parchment that could have looked like a gap where a comma would be. Anyway, they took it all very seriously, but it was a pretty hopeless defence. And Casement himself was resigned. He'd done his best. He'd had an extraordinary lifetime. And he was, I think, quite resigned to being a martyr. I think he knew that Irish independence would come soon, but he had done all he could do for the cause.
Why do you think Casement isn't as celebrated in Ireland as he should be, given that he was this international humanitarian who had done such extraordinary work exposing atrocities in the Congo and in the Amazon jungle and so on, and his role during the First World War and in 1916 and the circumstances of the trial, and even the fact that the way his sexuality was used against him, you would think would make him more of an icon today? Was it that in the decades after, he was just maybe an uncomfortable subject for people in the new Irish state? Or was it the fact that he was hanged in England, and perhaps if the trial had taken place in Ireland, it might have given him a greater prominence?
I think that's a very good question. I think part of it, again, is to do with his sexuality. I think the Irish establishment were not comfortable with the exposures around his homosexuality. Certainly Eamon de Valera, I read, was uncomfortable about that, even though it was finally de Valera who got his body brought back in 1965. So he wasn't brought back for a proper Irish state funeral till 1965. So I think it's partly that. I think it's partly the other 15 men executed for their part in the Easter Rising had, as you say, all been in Ireland, whereas he was coming back to try to stop it in some way, which sort of compromised his reputation. But I think the fundamental point is his sexuality again.
And Roland, whenever people talk about Casement, so much of the attention goes on the diaries and whether they were forged, whether they were genuine, rather than, you know, looking, as you have, on how they were used against him, which I think is the more significant thing. But how do you respond to people who still refused to accept that the diaries were genuine?
Well, nowadays we can point to the scientific proof that came about in 2000, which I think Bertie Ahern wrote to Tony Blair in 1999 saying you must settle this question once and for all. And Blair instituted a scientific analysis which proved they're genuine. But I say that his sexuality was all of a piece with him, as it were. I think it led to this secrecy, this loneliness, but also, and that secrecy and loneliness was what fueled his passionate reform as both as a humanitarian and as an Irish nationalist. So my response to that is that these days we know the diaries were genuine, and we have to, I think it's only once you accept that you can understand the whole of him. And that is what I've tried to do in Broken Archangel, is present the full man, as it were.
And it's a wonderful title. Why did you pick that, Broken Archangel? And why the subheading, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement?
Take the subheading first, because I found he had these three distinct lives, or two distinct lives, one as a humanitarian, and then, even though it only took place over the last 5 years of his life, this extraordinary life as a nationalist. So it's a climbing of the mountain to international hero, and then the same assets in his character that made him an international hero brought about his tragedy. So that's the lives. And Broken Archangel was something T.E. Lawrence, another homosexual, great sympathizer with the oppressed, in his case, the Arabs. T.E. Lawrence wrote a letter shortly before his death saying, I'm considering a biography of Roger Casement. He seems to me a broken archangel. So that's where I got the title, and then T.E. Lawrence died. But Broken Archangel seemed to me to sum up this man who was an extraordinarily good man who saved the lives of millions, brought the deaths of millions to to attention, worldwide attention, but at the same time was so divided in himself that in the end his tragedy came about. So that seems to me T.E. Lawrence absolutely summed it up when he called him that.
Well, it's a brilliant new study of the remarkable Roger Casement. It's called Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement, published in hardback and paperback by Bodley Head. The author is Roland Phillips. And Roland, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. The Anglo-French War of 1294 to 1303 has not been the subject of a major study in over a century. Recent histories tend to treat it as a sideshow compared to Edward I's wars in Wales and Scotland, which gives a false impression. In reality, the Welsh and Scottish campaigns were distractions, and Edward regarded the war against France as his main focus. Well, a new book places the war in its proper context and argues that it was a vital step on the road to the more famous conflict we remember as the 100 Years' War. The book is called Edward Longshanks' Forgotten Conflict, The Anglo-French War, 1294 to 1303. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is David Pilling. And David, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So maybe tell us about this conflict. What is the relationship between Edward and the King of France?
Well, Edward and the King of France, Philip the Fair, Philip the Fourth, were first cousins once removed. And they are heads of the royal houses of Plantagenet and Capet. And to begin with, they have a more sort of harmonious, mutually beneficial relationship, because Philip is only 17 when he becomes king in 1285. But as the years pass and Philip sort of consolidates his position in France and becomes more confident, the relationship between them gets more fractious. And by 1294, basically, you have this sort of simmering conflict at sea that then breaks out into open warfare between England and France.
And at the heart of it is the desire to recover Aquitaine.
Yes. Basically, what happens if we rewind to 1259, Edward's father, Henry III, had signed away pretty much all of his ancestral lands in France to the King of France, with the exception of Aquitaine, which he received back as a fief, which means that from then on, Henry and his successors will hold this land as vassals of the kings of France, which is a very awkward and ultimately unworkable relationship. And the French kings decide quite quickly after 1259 that actually they don't like this at all, and they'd rather just have Aquitaine back along with everything else. And of course, the kings of England are determined to cling on to it. And so you have decades of intermittent conflict leading up to what we call the Hundred Years' War.
And what's fascinating is that this isn't just a local or a regional conflict. It engulfs most of Western Europe, because they look for allies across the continent and they find them, and you have various different other parts getting involved in it.
Yeah, that's right. It really does encompass, as you say, much of Western Europe, as well as Scotland and Scandinavia. I mean, Edward's Scottish Wars, which are, you know, probably the most famous thing about him, they're actually part of this wider conflict, because Philip enlists the Scots as allies, as well as the Norwegians, whilst Edward enlists all of these expensive allies in the Low Countries and Flanders. And then if you go to the other end of Europe, the kingdoms beyond the Pyrenees, Aragon and Castile, Navarre, they all get involved and they send mercenaries to fight. And so for a relatively short period, a year or so, much of Europe and Scandinavia is technically at war with each other, because these two kings have decided to fight over a province in southwest France.
And yet, despite all of this, neither side was really able to find an advantage.
No, not really. They sort of cancel each other out. I mean, the French, Philip, should probably have won because they enjoy all the sort of territorial and strategic advantages. I mean, to get to Aquitaine, they just have to march overland, whilst Edward has to send things down from England, which is quite difficult, logistically difficult at the time. But they both end up spending enormous amounts of money on this war and on enlisting allies to fight each other. And it all sort of fizzles out into this very awkward stalemate. There are no decisive battles fought. And I think in the end, Edward and Philip realise that they don't actually want to embrace sort of mutually assured destruction. So they back away.
And all along, there are a series of very bloody incidents and battles. And, you know, they wouldn't be out of place in Game of Thrones, where you have prisoners being hanged from the walls and you have various acts of violence and vengeance.
Yeah, quite. I mean, the war has been characterised by previous historians as a bit of a non-event, which when you actually look at what went on, you know, you have to think, well, from whose perspective? Because if you were one of the Gascons who was hanged from the walls of La Riol, or was killed in battle at Bongard and other places, or you were the Frenchman who accidentally tipped a bucket of rocks on his own head, which happened at one of the sieges, and buried himself alive. I mean, it's pretty serious stuff from their perspective.
So in what way then did it lead to the 100 Years' War? Is it that there were unresolved issues and tensions that were going to be left simmering until a later conflict?
Essentially, yes. The problem is the status of Aquitaine. It's, although, I mean, this war ends in 1303, it sort of bubbles under for 20 years, and then there's further conflicts towards the end of the reign of Edward II going into Edward III. And the issue is that the English cannot break free of this very awkward subordinate feudal relationship with the French crown. And the kings of France cannot, despite their best efforts, extend direct conquest over this sort of last irritating bit of English-held territory in France. And in the end, Edward III in the 1330s decides that he's just going to sort of cut this Gordian knot, declare himself King of France and try and conquer France, which is a tall order. And obviously he doesn't manage it in the end. But in my opinion, it is very much this vexed issue of sovereignty in Aquitaine that leads to that point.
So why do you think there has been so little focus on this conflict? And why have historians tended to focus on Edward's wars in Wales and Scotland?
I think there are various reasons. Edward's wars in the British Isles have perhaps had a more sort of long-lasting impact. And from about the 1800s onwards, certainly the Welsh and Scottish wars were the focus of sort of nationalist, a rising awareness of national history. Edward's castles in Wales are still very much present. You know, they're this sort of big physical reminder of his conquest of the country. Scotland, you know, you have these flagship figures, the patriotic heroes like Robert the Bruce and William Wallace, and all these recent films like Outlaw King and Braveheart, which have popularized them. Whereas the war in France, it's a much more sort of messy, complex process. And Gascony itself, or Aquitaine, I mean, it doesn't help that it's got several names for a start, which makes it even more confusing, and is now part of France. But for a long while, it was technically a province ruled from England, and the people who lived in Aquitaine did not regard themselves as French. They had their own custom and dialect. And I think it's a shame in a way that it gets forgotten, because it's just as valid as anything else.
So how is Edward viewed now? Because most people will know him from the movie Braveheart, where he's the villain and he's played by Patrick McGoohan. Mm. And I think that would very much shape how a lot of people would think of him now.
Well, interestingly, I went to this part of France last year. It's now called Nouvelle-Aquitaine. And Edward he's mentioned quite often there in the sort of various local museums. The perspective on him there is very different to sort of Scotland, for instance. He's remembered in southwest France as a king who built towns and encouraged trade and preserved their sort of autonomy from the northern French. And he's a completely different figure to this sort of, as you say, the villainous Longshanks in Braveheart. Who, by the way, I've no objection to that, because Patrick McGoohan is by far and away the best thing in the film. It's a completely different person, really. You wouldn't think they were the same individual.
So what do you see as the legacy of the conflict then, and I suppose the legacy of his kingship?
Of Edward's kingship? He is, his rule of Aquitaine, or as King Duke of Aquitaine, this sort of awkward title, was really the most sort of efficient that that the duchy ever knew under the kings of England for the 20 years that he's got effective control of Aquitaine. It's run very efficiently. He revives the administration, he reforms the legal system as he did in England. And it's a real shame that this war had to break out because that kind of ruined all of the work he'd done. And really the war was a result of French aggression in the same way that the war in Scotland was the result of English aggression. There's this sort of weird paradox about it. Edward is remembered quite rightly as the aggressor in Scotland, but it's a very different story in Aquitaine where this conflict was forced upon him and turned out to be completely futile.
And is there an element that Philip IV of France, that he just misjudged Edward and perhaps had took a lot of the relationship for granted, and it was his arrogance that was to blame for a lot of it starting?
Philip is very tough man to read. Even his contemporaries sort of referred to him as the owl because he just sort of stared at you and nobody could really figure out what he was thinking. When he was on his deathbed in 1314, one of the last things he said was that all my decisions were my own. You know, I wasn't getting my ideas from advisors. It was all me. And so whatever I've succeeded or failed at is all my responsibility. And, you know, you have to sort of take him at his word, really. And so I think, yes, in 1294, he did underestimate perhaps the resolve of the English and the people of Gascony to remain autonomous from the rest of France. I mean, because it's not just the English, the Gascons do not want to be ruled from Paris. And it's really down to them that it remains, the province remains independent of France up until 1453.
Well, it's a fascinating story. The book is called Edward Longshanks' Forgotten Conflict, The Anglo-French War, 1294 to 1303. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing, the author David Pilling. And David, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
In the 200 years since it was founded, the RNLI has saved more than 144,000 lives. It all began with a meeting in London in 1824 to act on a proposal by Sir William Hillary, the formation of a national institution for the preservation of life from shipwreck. And it's his vision that still drives the RNLI today. And to talk to me about the history of the RNLI on this, its 200th year anniversary, I'm delighted to be joined by Helen Doe, the author of One Crew, the RNLI's official 200 year history. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. And Helen, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hello, it's lovely to talk to you.
So talk to me about the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, the RNLI, because this year is the 200th anniversary. So maybe tell me about its role today and just how significant it is.
Well, it has an incredible significance amongst so many people as an organisation that takes a lot of hardworking people, volunteers who go out and risk their lives to save others. It is incredible charity. When I was researching and writing my book, I found that almost anybody I met had some sort of connection or story with this amazing charity. It was quite incredible.
And I think it's important to note that it's not just a rescue service for the United Kingdom. It's also here in Ireland as well.
Absolutely vital to make sure people understand that. It's something that I think is really powerful about the strength of the charity, that it goes right across borders.
So let's go back in time 200 years then to Sir William Hillary. What was his vision?
He was living on the Isle of Man. He was sort of self-exiled there. And he had been involved in several shipwrecks, the Isle of Man being quite a kind of crossroads for shipping. And he realised that the sort of provision of lifeboats was very ad hoc around the coasts. And so it was a matter of luck if you were shipwrecked, whether there might be somebody nearby that could help you. And he felt there should be something national to provide a more coordinated approach right around our coasts of Britain and Ireland.
And he seems a fascinating figure, impulsive. I think he was bankrupt at one point, but yet had this courageous vision for what could be achieved.
Yes, absolutely. I think you put your finger on it. He was a very restless man, very impulsive, incredibly brave man as well. But on his own, especially living in the Isle of Man, he couldn't achieve it on his own. So he needed people who could put his amazing vision, but that vision couldn't be put into action without the help of other people. And that's where he was able to garner support to establish this embryo organisation.
And there are some incredible rescues over that 200-year history. You know, I was reading about the 1899 gales in the Bristol Channel, where a lifeboat was trapped in the harbour and then there was a sailing ship in trouble. So they ended up knocking down walls so that they could go out and rescue it.
There are some amazing stories I came across in my work. It's, yes, nothing got in people's way and doesn't today. In Ireland, there were several instances where there wasn't a lifeboat nearby to help. So they got the lifeboat from some distance away, on one occasion putting it on a railway line and then dragging it to where they could launch it to rescue the men.
So when Ireland became an independent free state in 1922, how come there wasn't a split there then? And I suppose how significant was the chairman of the RNLI in Ireland, Andrew Jameson, in ensuring there wasn't a split?
Andrew Jameson, I think, was really important. And he's not a name that's particularly come up through previous histories of the RNLI. I was curious about this, you know, how did this happen, that this charity continued in the way it has? And Andrew Jameson was a politician. He was part of Jameson's Whiskey, of course. And he was trusted by everybody. During the Civil War, he was trusted by all sides and became something of a broker, a peace broker. But he was also, as you already mentioned, chairman of the RNLI in Dublin. And so I think as someone who was trusted by everybody, the Irish government had to set up so many new organisations. So setting up a separate life-saving organisation would have been quite significant. But with Jameson being trusted and a well-known broker between so many people, I believe he was really key in ensuring that that continued.
And then that interwar period between the First World War and the Second World War was crucially important then in assuring that it did continue in Ireland.
Yes, and there's another name that I think that has been, again, slightly ignored in RNLI history. When the Free State was established, there was a Governor General, and his name was O'Neill. And his wife, Josephine McNeill, was asked to help with the Dublin Ladies' Guild. The Ladies' Guild, throughout all of the problems, had been continuing to raise money. I mean, formidable women. But it wasn't easy. And Josephine McNeill didn't just take on the role of president of this guild as a kind of nominal one. She actively organised everybody and trebled their charitable takings. Later on, post-war, she became one of the first Irish diplomats, first lady diplomat, something that in her biography, they say, wasn't always well accepted in establishment circles. Quite a lady.
Extraordinary. Well, the book is called One Crew, the RNLI's Official 200-Year History. It's published in hardback by Amberley Publishing. The author is Helen Doe. And Helen, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, to Hannah Flam, and to Peter Malloy. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.